Hi, my name's June. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I really want to thank all of you for allowing me to be part of this conference, but especially your committee, many of whom are people that I got to meet in 1981 and who have a very, very special place in my heart. I can't think of any place other than maybe local to where I live in Los Angeles where there could be this many people in a room that are this special and that mean this much in my life. And I got a chance to see a lot of them today just wandering around, and some of them tonight. I had a very special time in Florida in 1981. It was a chance for me to come and see John and Helen, who had become a very special part of my life. And while I was here, I got to meet Stu and Howie and Patty. And got to meet Joe and Shipwreck. And a lot of people who I don't see very often, but who I think about a lot. And who make me laugh. And who it's always a pleasure to hear from or to run into. And I was very touched this year when Stu called and told me that many of those people were on the committee. And that they had like gotten together and that they'd like to invite me back. And it really is a privilege. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't like everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard someone say, if you like everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're not going to enough meetings. And I think that's probably true. The most important thing that I want to say tonight, especially if you're new or visiting, is that I'm not an authority on alcoholism or on Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I'm not paid to get up here and talk. I'm just another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to stand here for a while and share my experience, strength, and hope, what of it I have. It's important that you know that I'm not paid here. It's important that you know that Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. Had it not been free when I came here, I never could have come. Had it not remained free, I never could have stayed. And I know when I'm done, some of you will say, thank God they didn't have to pay her for that. But I remember when I went to conventions and I really thought people were paid to get up there, you know, and tell their stories. And that isn't the way it is around here. The highest you go is sober. I live a life today that I never would have wanted any part of, and I am a person today that I wouldn't have even liked when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet I am happier than I have ever been. And I was never really a happy person. We were talking, a couple of us, after the meeting this morning, which I thought was just fantastic. I was delighted to be able to hear Ken share. And we were talking about a speaker, and somebody was saying, you know, have you heard so-and-so? And I said, I'm one of those people that I can't remember the name of who the hell told the story. You know, but it's like if someone ever asks me, did you hear about the guy who talks about the Doberman that took steroids? You know, I'm going to know that I heard that that's a Rottweiler and that that was Ken. But I won't probably remember Ken's name. And I'm just sort of a story person. And I was thinking about so many stories that have meant so much to me for some reason this weekend. One of my favorite stories is this friend of mine, Julie. And Julie tells a story about when she was new. She wasn't able to drive. I mean, she had known how to drive, but she wasn't able to drive because she was just too crazy and she was new, you know. And one day she was standing there and she was waiting for a bus, and she had to get the bus because she had to get home, because when she got home she had to make dinner because her husband was one of those people that had to have dinner on the table. And otherwise, you know, they'd have a fight and then it would be a problem. And that night was her home group. And she had to be at her home group. You know, I mean, you know how it is when you're new. You gotta be at your home group. I mean, you always gotta be at your home group. So she was standing there and she was waiting and the bus wouldn't come. And where was the bus? And she stood there and she's like, well, I got it. Where's the bus? You know, and the bus isn't there. And she started to pray for the bus and the bus didn't come. And then it started to rain and Julie started to cry. And then she thought of drinking, you know, which it makes sense when you're new. If the bus isn't here, I should drink. And so she's standing there and suddenly this woman in a Mercedes stopped at the bus stop and rolled down her little electric window and said, you know, don't you go to my home group? And they said yes. And so she got in and the woman gave Julie a ride home, and Julie was able to prepare dinner, and she made it to her home group. And later on, she realized that this woman who'd given her a ride had given her a ride home so that she'd gotten home 10 minutes earlier than she would have gotten if she'd gotten the bus that was scheduled to arrive that she was waiting for. And she thought about it more, and she said, you know, that during the years of her sobriety, she's thought about that, because there she was standing on the corner praying for a bus, and God sent her a Mercedes. And that's one of the stories that has helped me be able to use the prayer in my life, "Thy will, not mine, be done." Because I don't want to stand there and ask for a bus when God's sending the Mercedes. And a lot of times things have worked out that way for me. I also was thinking about my home group, the Monday Night Venice group, one of our old-timers, Serenity Sam, used to tell this story. And when Sam got sober, you know, back in the old days, a long time ago, you know, he was one of your typical newcomers, and he wanted to just sober up absolute strangers. And he used to drive everybody in the club kind of crazy back then, because, you know, he was just one of those real hyper newcomers that just loved AA and just loved to be sober and just wanted to tell everybody about it all the time. And so the old-timers used to kind of make up 12-step calls to get rid of them. They were fake, and they'd send him out and just get him out there for an hour or two. And sometimes he'd come back with somebody, you know, but one time they sent Sam out, and he told the story, and they sent him out, and they said, "Now look, Sam, we want you to go down and talk to this guy, but we want you to know that he has a shotgun, so be careful." So Sam went out, and he was just about to knock on this screen door at this house when all of a sudden the shotgun went off and blew out a piece of the ceiling. And that made Sam a little nervous, as gung-ho as he was about AA. So he took out a piece of paper, and he wrote Sam, AA, and he wrote his phone number down, and he left it in the screen door, and he left. And about 2 days later, this drunk calls Sam. He says, "Well, Sam, need AA, Sam." And so Sam drove out, you know, found out what bar he was in, and picked the guy up and scooped him up and took him to a meeting. And then after the meeting, he took him home, and he gave him about 20 cups of coffee. And several hours later, this guy was sort of sobering up, you know. And Sam said, "Boy, I'm really glad you called." And the guy said, "Yeah." And Sam said, "You know, I've been waiting for your call." He said, I would have knocked on the door, but that shotgun thing really scared me." And the drunk guy kind of looked at him, and he was fairly sober, you know, at this point. He said, "What, shotgun, what are you talking about?" Sam said, "You know, 2 or 3 days ago," he said, "when I was out at your house, and I left my note with my phone number on your screen door." He said, "I've been waiting for you to call." And the guy says, "Screen door?" He said, "I don't know what you're talking about." He said, "I was just sitting in the Red Lion Saloon. I looked down on the bar, and there was this piece of paper. It said, 'Sam, if you want help, AA, call,' and I called it." And that guy's been sober ever since. And so Sam. And there's been so many different stories like that I've heard people share that help me believe that when I'm worried about someone that's out there and I'm thinking maybe they're not going to get here or maybe they're not going to stay, and that kind of gives me a little bit of hope. I'm one of those people that believes I was born an alcoholic. I don't want to have a philosophical discussion with any of you about that after the meeting. It's just something I believe. And I believe that because there was something wrong with me before I ever started to drink. And the way that manifested itself in me was in suicide attempts. And from the time that I was 5 years old, I began to try and kill myself on a regular basis. And as I think back on it, I don't really believe there were any days before I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't try and take my own life, put myself in a position where someone else would take my life, or pray to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please let me die. I wanted out. I'm not one of those people that was that have ever been a social drinker. I've never wanted a social drink in my life. I just can't see the point of it at all. I've gotten drunk every time I've ever drank, and I always wanted more. I never thought I was there. I started to use drugs on a regular basis when I was 7. I'd been taking overdoses of baby aspirin for 2 years by then. That was all I knew about at the time. I started to drink on a regular basis when I was 8, and by the time I was 9, I found a combination that I never altered in any way. That was alcohol and barbiturates or downers or sleeping pills, whatever you might know them as, and alcohol. The combined effect of those got me exactly where I wanted to go. I wanted complete oblivion. I wasn't interested in feeling good. I wasn't a party girl. I don't have any cute, funny stories to tell you about the things I did when I was drinking. If you drank the way that I did and you took the things I did, you didn't do much either, you know. I done a lot of overdosing. I've done a lot of throwing up, and that pretty much sums up my drunkalog. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I knew about alcoholism firsthand. And there were all the same things in my home as there are in any other alcoholic home. There was a lot of violence, there was a lot of abuse, and there was a lot of broken promises. And I knew that that wasn't the way that I was going to live my life. And yet when I was introduced to alcohol when I was 8 years old, I knew that I was never going to give it up. Because it was the first time that the pain ever went away when I found it. And I lived in constant pain. And that was the how and the why of the way that I drank, was so that I didn't feel anything at all. I wasn't interested in feeling good. I wasn't interested in having a good time. I just didn't want to feel anything at all, and that was how it worked for me. I'm one of those people that's very grateful I found alcohol and chemicals when I did, because I happen to believe I would have been locked up in some kind of an institution had I not found them, because it was all too painful for me. It just always was. My memories go back to the time that I was about 5, and in thinking back at that time, I know that I was an observer of people. I was watching at that time, I know today, mostly alcoholics. But the people that I watched, as I recall, in my memory, I don't ever remember seeing a man cry under any circumstances before I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have seen men shot, stabbed, beaten, taken to jail, had their wives leave them, had their kids die, any number of situations. And I never saw him shed a tear. And I thought that meant one thing. It meant that they never got hurt. It meant that they never felt any kind of pain. And on the other hand, I watched those women going through some of the same situations, and many of them didn't cry, but a lot of them did. And I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my life trying to be what I thought a man was, and to me, a man was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing, and if they did, they never let anyone know it. And as far as I was concerned, the only acceptable emotion was anger and rage, and that was how I tried to live my life. Without the use of alcohol, however, I seem to be one of those people that Clancy talks about that was born without any insulation whatsoever for my feelings. When I think back on going to school at 5 and 6 years old, I can remember being on the playground and having the kids tease me about being tall or being skinny or having curly red hair or whatever it was. And if I wanted to really think about it, I could remember exactly the pain, just how much it hurt. I felt like I was being cut up inside. And these were absolute strangers. These were people that didn't even matter to me. And so I found out that when I look back upon it, that I was the thing that I hated the most. Because to me, a person who felt emotions and couldn't control them meant only one thing. It meant that you were weak. And throughout my life, there was not anything that I could tolerate less in anyone, most of all myself, than those things that I was going to decide were weaknesses. And to feel any emotion other than anger or rage meant that you were weak. And so I found out from the earliest memory that I have that I was the thing that I hated the most, that I was weak. And those feelings of self-hatred were to grow and grow the longer that I was out there. And it was those feelings that actually drove me into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and kept me here. By the time I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't have hated myself one more 1,000th of an inch. And gone on. I just couldn't go on that way. And that was what drove me here. When I was a little kid and they asked me what I wanted to be when I grow up, I said, a boy. Wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. Caused my family a lot of concern and they began to take me to priests. And eventually we were on welfare. My mom found out she could take me to psychiatrists and psychologists. And she began taking me there to find out why I wanted to be a boy. And I don't have any kind of diagnosis to give you about, you know, why they thought I hated myself or I was trying to kill myself all the time or why I wanted to be a boy or anything else. Because I felt about psychiatrists and psychologists much like my friend Patty Hicks always did. I always thought they should have to work for their money, and so I never told them anything. I never filled out one form. I never answered one question. I sat there the required period of time, and then I got up and I left. Somewhere along the line, I accepted within myself that I was not going to be able to be a boy, and I settled for the next best thing. And as I saw the world, the only opportunity or option for someone like me was to be a tough broad. And I spent all my time before coming in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. And I was willing to go to any lengths to do that. I grew up in Venice, and that's a beach town out in Los Angeles. And we had certain standards for tough broads out there. I don't know how similar they are to people here in Florida, but I'll go ahead and run some of them by you. It was very important that you be in a gang, and I was. It was very important that you do a lot of fighting, and I did. I have never won a fight in my life, but I have never fought less than 5 people at a time. And my sponsor explained to me that the reason I always fought 5 or more when I got here, that my sponsor said that the reason I always fought 5 or more is because if you fight one person and you lose, some people are going to think you're not a very good fighter. But if you always fought 5 or more, nobody ever expects you to win, and they think you must be pretty tough, or why would that many people have to jump you? And that was sort of how I got by out there. It was very important that if you were going to be a tough broad in Venice that you not ever wear shoes, because it was a beach town and I didn't. One of my favorite things to do would I'd be standing down there with my gang looking tough, and I'd take my cigarette and I'd throw it down on the boardwalk and I'd put it out with my bare feet when touristy looking people walked by. And sometimes I'd see those touristy-looking people whisper back and forth, and I knew what they were saying. They were saying, "Wow, she is one tough broad." And I was very impressed that I could do this, and I was sure they were even more impressed, you know, than even I was. My sponsor explained to me after I'd been sober for a while that maybe what some of those people were saying was, "Did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid?" You know, but I thought it was, you know, very tough, and so I did it all the time. Just being able to step on lit cigarette butts did not mean you were tough. You were only truly tough if you were then able to walk upon those feet as if it did not hurt. And those are the kind of things that kept me busy before I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, if I've been grateful in the years since I've been sober that tattoos were not particularly popular when I was on the streets. I have a number of friends in the program who have tattoos, some before they got here and some even after. And many of them have cute little things like a butterfly or a flower or, you know, a little bumblebee or something like that. If tattoos had been popular when I was on the street, I'd be standing up here tonight. I'd have a shark on my arm. It would swim whenever I did this. I would have gotten something like a battleship on my chest or maybe a canoe in my case, but if I had thought it was tough, I mean, there isn't any question in my mind that I would have done it. The last fight that I had, I was walking, I was in my house, and my gang came by, and they said, "If you come out of the house, we're going to beat you up." And I closed the door, I got dressed, and I immediately came outside, because I didn't want anyone ever to think that I was afraid of anything. I would not recognize fear. It was not an emotion that was acceptable. It wasn't in my standards. And I got dressed and I came outside and I started to walk down the street and they started to follow me and I thought to myself, you know, if I take the street, they're going to probably beat me up. But if I don't take the alley, they're going to think it's because I'm afraid to take that alley, and I didn't want anybody to ever think I was afraid to do anything. And so I took the alley and they beat me up. And as I was laying in the alley and one of them was knocking my head against the asphalt, somebody else was kicking me and beating me. I really don't remember why they chose to do that particular day. They kept hitting me, and I don't know how long it went on, but when I finally got up, I had a bloody lip and I had a black eye, and they walked away and got bored, I guess. And if you'd asked me at that particular moment, I would have told you I just won that fight. Because as they were hitting me and they were kicking me and they were beating me up, all they wanted that day was they wanted me to cry. And like I said, I don't know how long they went on that day, but I didn't shed one tear. And as far as I was concerned, that meant that I won. And that was that important to me that I believe at this, you know, as I look back on it, that if they'd have chosen to hit me until I was dead, I probably would have let them do it rather than shed one tear. And as I think on it tonight, it just seems absolutely ridiculous. Somebody walked up to me and they said, "Hey, June, I'll tell you what, I'm going to slap you around the face. You can cry a few tears." I'd cry a few tears. I mean, who really cares, you know? But at that point in time in my life, there just wasn't that option. I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with my mother. She brought me. I didn't come because I wanted help. I didn't come because I had a problem, and that isn't really why she brought me. She brought me because she was afraid if she left me alone, I'd get her evicted from another apartment. And I walked in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the miracle began for me that night, even though I didn't get sober. It began because there was someone in that meeting that I admired more than anyone else in the whole world. And I did not admire very many people, but I admired this guy. And I admired Paul for some reasons many of you may not identify with. I admired Paul because he was from Venice, because he'd been to prison, because he had tattoos, because he rode a motorcycle, because he carried a knife and had it with him at the meeting, because he was one of the most hostile and violent people I had ever known. And I looked at him and I thought, "Wow, I never thought people this great came to AA." I was very impressed. If I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence when I came to the program, I wanted the ability to walk into rooms full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens. But Paul was a drinking friend of my mother, and I had seen him walk into bars and seen him walk into to houses or parties. And he was the kind of guy that once he'd been drinking and he wanted to sit where you just gave him the whole table. You know, you didn't even talk to him, because once he'd been drinking, he was so crazy and he was so mean, you just didn't know what he was going to do. And so I looked at this man who had achieved everything that I wanted out of life, the ability to clear rooms and tables, and he was sitting in an AA meeting, and it made a big impression on me. I got drunk the next night, and then I came back to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't raise my hand because I wasn't an alcoholic. I was too young to be an alcoholic, and even if I'd been an alcoholic, I wouldn't have raised my hand because I wasn't going to join any organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. So I went to some meetings, and in between the meetings, I talked to Paul. He was one of the only people I talked with. He was one of the only cool people, you know, that was here. And so I could talk to him. Everybody else was very uncool, and I didn't talk to them. So I talked to Paul, and I explained to Paul in between the meetings that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I wasn't anything like my mother, who was very alcoholic, that I was too young to be an alcoholic, that I had places to go, people to see, things to do. I had my whole life ahead of me, and I was really clearly not alcoholic. I later learned that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholic. They already know that, you know. And Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, I'm pretty new in this AA thing. And they tell me I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. So I've seen the way that you drink and I've seen the way that you use chemicals. And I happen to believe if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you, within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't trying to make up a story like your teacher in high school does about something they don't know anything about. He was just talking about facts. He was talking about things that had happened in his life. He was talking about things that had happened and were beginning to happen in mine. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think I'd gone that low. And in that 2 week period of time, as I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. I've already mentioned earlier how much I hated myself when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only person that I hated more than my mother was myself. But I hated my mother in a particular way. I blamed her for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life. It's extremely convenient if you happen to have an alcoholic parent to do that with until you hang around the program and you start working the steps and learn to do something different. But I certainly didn't know about that then. And because of the way that I felt about this woman, I used to attack her physically. And because my mother was sober at this time, she no longer thought she had to be subjected to those kind of attacks in her home, and she asked me to leave, and I did. The rest of my family had not talked to me in a couple of years. I was not allowed to call or come by under any circumstances, and I didn't even bother to try. I had been in 5 or maybe even 6 foster homes by that time. I had been thrown out of all of them. None of them would take me back. I tried to get into a few drug recovery and alcohol recovery homes that were available in the Los Angeles area. There were only a couple. None of them would take me, some because of my age and some because of my attitude. And then I thought, well, you know what? Who cares about all these family things and these programs and all that stuff? None of that really matters. If you're a tough broad, there's only one thing that counts. There's only one thing that's really important, and that's your gang. And then I told, as I said earlier, as I walked down that alley, all 5 members of my own gang beat me up. And so I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 87 pounds. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I had no shoes. Wouldn't have worn them if I'd had them at that time. I had no family. I had no friends. I had no place to live. I had no money. I had the clothes that I was wearing. And I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can see where it was kind of simple. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? You know, it was a lot easier decision than that. And when I raised my hand, I know that there were some people at that time that didn't know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. In particular, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason I figure maybe a couple of those people didn't know about that tradition is when I raised my hand, some of those people came up to me after the meeting and they told me I was too young to be an alcoholic. And they told me they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meetings while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back, they'd get together and throw me out. And that certainly wasn't everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was just a couple people. But I figured AA didn't want me either, and that was okay with me, because I didn't want me either. And I had it for a long, long time. And I fell back on my number one answer, the answer I'd been using since I was 5 years old. And I went over to a friend of my mother's, and I took enough pills to kill myself one more time. And before I passed out that day, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I got to the meeting, I couldn't stand and I couldn't sit. I laid in the meeting. I don't know about where you guys go to meetings here in Florida, but where I got sober in West Los Angeles, they almost never called on people to share who were laying in the meeting. But for some reason, they called on me to share. And I certainly can't tell you what I said. The next thing I remember is waking up in a hospital, and a doctor had given me medication to make me throw up and explained to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I don't know why that overdose was any different than all the others I'd inflicted upon myself during the years that I was out there. I just know that it was. Because since that time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. I've done that one day at a time, and the 13th of July of this year, I celebrated 17 continuous years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's very important, particularly if you're new, that you know that I never planned on staying here 17 years. At that particular time in my life, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, if they'd have given me the option of whether or not I wanted to live for 17 years or not, I would have checked the no box. I did not stay in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time or during the tough time because I was afraid of going out on the streets and dying. I've never thought I'd be that lucky. I tried to die as long and as hard as I could. I always figured I'd be one of the people that could go out there and live like I'd been living for another 20 or 30 years, and that's what I couldn't stand. I couldn't stand living out there that way anymore. I'm not one of those people who really stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted what you people had. I didn't really know what you had, and I certainly didn't see anything I really wanted. I just knew I couldn't stand what I had anymore. I came out of that hospital, and I went back to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I raised my hand. I'm very grateful, more and more the longer I'm sober, for the people who were here when I got here. I'm grateful for the people who tolerated me in Alcoholics Anonymous when I arrived. And tolerate is really the only appropriate word as I think back on it. There's a lot of different people and different kinds of newcomers that arrive in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are some real cuddly, lovable ones. I was not one of those. I was the tolerated type. I am very grateful. I think that the people who were here when I got here were more tolerant than I could be even today. I came to this program with a bad attitude. I don't want you to think I got sober and suddenly got this bad attitude. I simply came here with the only attitude I had ever had, and it had always been bad. I did not like women. I didn't like me. I didn't like my mother. I figured any other women around this AA thing had to be like one of the two of us, and I didn't like them. I wasn't going to sit next to women. I wasn't going to shake hands with women. Certainly wasn't going to hug women, and I didn't like listening to women speakers, which is something that always makes me feel better because I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like. Now, as far as men were concerned, the only men I'd ever known in my life were alcoholics who beat up women, and they scared me, and I didn't want anything to do with them either. Now, I had a problem, because in July of 1972, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, all we had were men and women, and I didn't like any of them. I went to 21 meetings a week, most of my first 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a very limited vocabulary when I got sober. Consisted almost solely of profanity. There were a few exceptions, the and mother. Found a lot of people in the program that were very offended by the use of that type of language, and so I used it more when they were around. I didn't wear shoes most of my first 2 years. It wasn't like I took them off to go to the meeting. I just didn't wear them anywhere. I wore motorcycle chains around my wrists and my ankles, and I wore a motorcycle jacket that said, "Do unto others," and then split. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day when I got here. I lit all of them myself. Occasionally someone would hold a match, and I allowed them to hold it as long as they liked. But they never lit my cigarette with it. Sometimes someone would hold the door open for me, and I allowed them to hold it until they got tired. And when the door closed, I opened it for myself only, and I went through the door. And I know today what I was trying to let everyone know back then is that I'm just fine all by myself. I don't need anyone to do anything for me. And I know how ridiculous that is, because no one who's fine all by themselves ever comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I thought I was kidding some people. After I'd been sober a short period of time, I took up smoking cigars and then later a pipe. I wore t-shirts on them that had sayings that most, if not all, people, including myself today, found extremely offensive. And what I'd like to let you know is if you choose to dress the way that I did, talk the way that I did, and smoke the way that I did, you too can sit in a meeting, maybe not quite this large, but fairly large, and have an entire row all to yourself. Because there are a whole lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are not going to want to have anything to do with you, and I don't blame them at all. But there were a few people who were willing to tolerate me as I was. One of them became one of my first sponsors, and he'd been out on the streets longer than I had. He was a lot more hostile than even I was, and when he thought I was getting out of hand, he would grab me around the neck and threaten to kill me. Now, you're not going to find that anywhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he was always able to get my attention long enough to tell me what the next meeting was that I'd be attending. I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've maintained that through the years in a variety of ways. But I got active, and I went to those 21 meetings a week, not because I wanted to get a gold star in AA, because I didn't have any place else to go. I didn't have anything else to do, and I didn't think this thing was going to work for me. Physically, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't in as bad a shape as a lot of people I've seen come in after me. But mentally, I was with some of the best of them, you know, as far as arriving. By the time I got here, I would stand at the door. I was the greeter at one of the regular meetings in Westwood. I'd stand there barefoot with my motorcycle jacket and chains and cigar welcoming the newcomer as they came in. Sometimes as they'd walk by, I'd hear their sponsor say, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that." And I'd stand there and I'd shake hands and I'd say, "My name's June," and somebody'd say, "My name's Kathy," and somebody else would walk up and say, "My name's Mary," and I'd say, "My name's Kathy," because by then I heard so many names I couldn't remember which one was mine. And I wasn't able to read by the time I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had once known how to read, but I just couldn't do it. I'd read the same sentence in the big book over and over and over, and I just couldn't hold that many words in my mind anymore. And I was unable to hold conversations with people, which is hard for most people who know me today to believe. But I'd be standing there talking to people, and suddenly I would bird, and I'd just go off on my own little trip there. I was many months sober, and I heard music. I don't mean just like, you know, melodies or something. I mean, I heard music. I heard words. I heard the background music. I heard harmony. I heard everything. And I never told anybody in AA that because I figured they would lock me up in some kind of a mental institution. And I was at a meeting once. I'd been sober a while, and this woman got up and took a 9-month chip and talked about hearing, you know, music sober without the radio being on. And I thought, my God, I should have talked about it. We'd probably been listening to the same station, you know. I was at the Monday Night Venice group. They said it was very important that you get the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that they sold it for exactly what they paid for it. They weren't going to make any kind of profit on the book. They said if you didn't have enough money to buy it, that they'd make liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week. And then at the Monday Night Venice group, they said, and if you're too afraid to talk to somebody or you don't want to talk to somebody, just go ahead and steal it. Well, I'd been stealing longer than I'd been drinking. I saw absolutely no reason to stop stealing just because I got sober. They were unrelated activities, and I didn't. But I was a little, you know, superstitious. I thought maybe if I steal the big book from an AA meeting, it'll jinx my sobriety. So instead, I went to the library, and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. While I was there, I stole a copy of the 12 and 12. No sense making two trips. I didn't have a car. It was very inconvenient. I remember I talked to one of my first sponsors, and that night, and I said, "Hi, Jeff, I stole the big book today." And I, you know, I thought back on this later on when I gave Jeff a 15-year cake. I thought, you know, Jeff didn't say to me, "You know, June, we no longer steal now that we're sober here in Alcoholics Anonymous." I remember he said, "That's great, kid, you got the book." Because for someone like me, if I thought it was important enough to steal it, it meant I was getting involved in the program. When I got to this program, I still had my black eye and my swollen lip, and it seemed to last for quite a while. People used to try and guess how old I was. When I first got sober, they were guessing me at 37, and I was 13. I have a seventh grade education. I dropped out of school. I already told you I wasn't able to read very good when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so instead of going back to school, which my sponsors thought might be a good idea, I went to 21 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week, and I got the kind of job that you can get with a seventh grade education. I did not live at home, and I have not ever gone back to live at home. I've been on my own since then. I just went to lots and lots of meetings. You know, my sponsors were really very practical people. They told me that if I wasn't willing to go back to school, that I was probably going to do jobs that people with seventh grade educations did. And that absolutely anything that I wanted to do or be could be possible here in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I had to do the same footwork anyone in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous had to do. That if I wanted to be president of General Motors, I couldn't just sit around the local club and wait for General Motors to call. I better find out what some former presidents had done and start doing it. And I wasn't willing to do that. Instead, I just went to lots and lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got the job that I could get. I had a very flexible schedule. It allowed me to work all kinds of split shifts and different hours and graveyards so that I could get to those 21 meetings a week. When I'd been sober a while, I got a chance to go to a business college and learn how to be a secretary. If there's anything in my life I never wanted to be, it was a secretary. There are very few tough broads who grow up to be secretaries. And even after I got sober, I still wanted to be a tough broad. I didn't wear anything pink until I was over 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just didn't want to be that kind of person, you know. I wanted to be tough. I wanted to be sure nobody could ever hurt me. I hoped that maybe Alcoholics Anonymous could teach me to have that strength of not caring and nobody mattering and those kind of things. And so I hung around. I was obsessed when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, or I don't know if obsessed is really the right word, but I was constantly plagued with the feelings about myself that I had always drank with, and over. When I got sober, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I hated myself so much that I couldn't even talk to people about it. I didn't take baths or showers even after I got sober. Some of it had to do with the fact that I didn't know how often you were supposed to do stuff like that. I never stood around with my gang talking about what kind of toothpaste we used or anything, you know, and I didn't know who to ask. I didn't want to look stupid. But most of it had to do with the fact that I didn't want to take a bath and wash myself off because I knew it wasn't going to do any good. I knew that I was nothing but a dirty little Venice broad. Because after I got sober, I wasn't so proud of all the people that I had hurt and taken advantage of and manipulated and used. And I had done a number of people, more than I could possibly imagine. I didn't know how to live with that sort of stuff. And I didn't know how to live with those same feelings that I'd had about myself since I was 5 years old. I hated everything about myself. I hated being tall. I hated being skinny. I hated the family that I came from. I hated having curly hair. I hated everything about myself. And there wasn't any question of me wearing makeup when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's different kinds of tough broads. There's makeup-wearing tough broads, and there are non-makeup-wearing tough broads. And I was always a non-makeup-wearing tough broad because there was never any way that I would have stood in front of a mirror long enough to look at myself. And when I got sober, I'd sit in these meetings and I'd hear different people get up here and share, and they'd share about how they hated themselves. And somewhere along the line, after they'd lost their self-worth or their self-respect, or maybe like me, they didn't think they'd ever had any until after they got in the program, somewhere along the line they'd done these things and they began to like themselves. They began to think of themselves as their own best friend. They could get out there and they could walk down the street and look other people right in the eye and just be one of God's kids. And I'd sit there and I'd think, that's not going to happen for me. I thought, but maybe if I do all these things, maybe if I really try, just like those people all did, then maybe someday when I look in a mirror, maybe I won't feel nauseous when I see what's looking back. And that was enough hope for me, that someday I could look at myself in a mirror and just not feel like throwing up to keep me coming back. After I finished working at that, or going to that secretarial school, I had to go out and look for a job. And, you know, when you're going to do that kind of work, you have to go to work in the citizen-y type world. That's what I called it. That's where people, like, dress up and they work Monday through Friday in the daytime. And those were citizen-y people. And I didn't know those kind of people very well. And I didn't know how to dress like they did or talk like they did, you know, and I knew you had to wear shoes and stuff. So people on the program took me out. We went to different Salvation Armies and thrift stores and bought me some clothes. And some women on the program gave me some things to wear to go on these job interviews and kind of taught me how you had to dress. I put these clothes on. It was kind of like Halloween. Look at the little Venice broad in the citizen costume, you know. And I went to all these different places, and I tried real hard to get a job. And I finally got a job, and I was so excited. And I worked really hard. And on the seventh day, they called me in the office. I thought maybe they were going to give me a raise. And they fired me. She said, I'm sorry, you don't have enough experience. And she said, and not only that, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever. Now, I did not know what that meant, but I knew I was being insulted, you know. And I went across the street and I called the Los Angeles Central Office. I said, this is June G. I'm a sober member. I've just been fired. What are you going to do about that? And they just laughed, you know. I mean, I'd been sober a couple years at that point. I had never heard of anybody sober being fired. I didn't think we were going to allow things like that to happen. I thought we would picket or something, you know. Sober AA member, wrongfully discharged, something like that. And I remember talking to my sponsor that night, and I said, you know, I never got fired before I came to AA. And he reminded me I'd never had a job. And sponsors have incredible insight, you know, to those kind of things. That had never occurred to me in my outrage. I mean, I think sponsorship, you know, when you're new, it's just so funny. You know, I heard this woman share this other story that I remember. You know, when you're You know when you're new and you've got a problem, like, for example, your rent, okay? Your rent is due, and you don't have any money. So you call your sponsor, all right? And you explain, okay, my rent is due tomorrow. I don't have any money. What do I do? And they say, go to a meeting. And say, all right, maybe the words I used were too big and I said it too fast, you know. Let me run this by you again. My rent is due tomorrow, and I don't have any money. And let me add, my landlord is not in AA, okay? They're not in AA. Okay, now I need some advice. What do I do? They say, go to a meeting, you know. And it's kind of like if you walked up to someone and you said, excuse me, what time is it? And they say, it's a horse. You know, it's just, it's no help whatsoever, you know. And they tell you to call your sponsor. I mean, what is that, you know, go to a meeting? I mean, how is that going to pay your rent? And somehow those kind of answers just make sense, you know. And it's, I have great fun now when people call me up and I say, go to a meeting, you know. Because I know it's going to work out. Anyway, I after I got fired from that job, I was at the time where I was making amends, including amends for book stealing. I had stolen a lot of books, great classics like Misty the Seahorse, kind of things you steal when you're 5 and 6 years old. And I loaded 40 or 50 books, including the Big Book and the 12 and 12 up, and I took them down to the local librarian in Culver City. I explained to her I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was necessary for my sobriety to return those books. I asked her, though, if I could make payments because they wanted 3 to 5 cents a day, and I'd had some of the books for 11 years. And she said that would be fine. She said she'd worked in this library in Laguna Beach, and this man had come in with a Big Book that he'd stolen. She said, I guess you guys do this all the time. Right around that time, it was time for me to go out there and look for another job, and I certainly wasn't feeling much better about myself having just been fired, but I went ahead and I did the footwork and I kind of showed up and filled out this application in a bank. I thought that was kind of funny. I'd never been in a bank in my life, you know, and I, being a thief and all, and I filled out this application and I got called back on a series of interviews, and I not only got hired to work in the bank, they put me to work in the vault, and I didn't even know if AA worked that good, you know. But I didn't steal anything while I worked there. It was amazing. And while I was there, I ended up going to school at night, took a couple classes while I worked full-time, and stayed active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And several months later, I got offered a job on campus at the school so I could take more classes, and I started to do that. And I just did that one day at a time. And a couple years later, they called me in the office, and they told me that I'd completed all the requirements for what they called an AA college degree. I thought that was a good name for a college degree. I never wanted a college degree, you know, it wouldn't have even been on my list when I walked through doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you know, I just wasn't even thinking of it. And yet, it was something that I was amazed had happened. Before I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I never went to school Monday through Friday, all day ever in my life. I never did it. I didn't do it without being truant or playing sick or leaving early or going late or not going at all or whatever it was. And when I graduated from there, I had learned to just show up. And I hadn't taken off for any classes at all in the 3 years or so that it took me to finish that that program. And I went there to their little graduation class, and I put on my cap and my gown, which I'd never worn before in my life, and some members of my family were there, and a couple sets of sponsors and foster parents, and I walked down the aisle there to get my diploma, and they announced I was graduating third in my class out of 475 students. And that was the same person... I was the same person that used to stand at the door and couldn't remember which name was theirs. That was the same person who came to Alcoholics Anonymous, couldn't read one sentence in the book and remember from the first word to the last. So there isn't really any question of who made that possible. It certainly wasn't June. You know, I showed up, but it's Alcoholics Anonymous that made something like that possible in my life. I couldn't do it. There isn't any question about that. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew how to survive. I knew how to get by on the streets, maybe not as well as some of you, maybe a little better than some of you. But I knew absolutely nothing about living, and I have learned how to live here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't always like it, but I get out there and I do it. I went ahead and I continued with school, and I graduated from college a couple years later, and I'd had this dream, And like I said, my sponsors being pretty practical people, they taught me to do the footwork for it. And I went ahead and I did the footwork for my dream, and I got a telegram, it's been almost 9 years ago now, telling me I had been chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. Now I'll tell you, when I walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always plan on spending a lot of time in court. But never on that side of the table. And I began law school in 1980. Practice law. And I have a job that I love very, very much. Now, you know, it's kind of funny. There's a guy named Sandy Beach that I know a lot of you have heard. And Sandy talks about the fact that, you know, sometimes you hear a speaker that's been sober for a while, right? And they stand up there and they say, you know, I'm a lawyer and, you know, things are great and da, da, da. And you think, oh, my God, you know, I mean, it was just like they never had any bad days ever. They never had any doubts. They never had any problems. It was just perfect. And the way that Sandy tells this story that I love so much is he says, you think about a guy that you know, right? And he comes to your discussion meeting, for example, and he's, I don't know, 4 or 5 years sober or somewhere in there, and he's just been fired. And he doesn't know where he's going to get the money to make his house payment. He doesn't know how he's going to support his family. And he sits in the discussion meeting for weeks on end. And you know, not even just in the discussion meeting. I mean, it's anybody who says, how are you? And he's got to tell him this, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how this could happen. I mean, I've just been fired. I don't know how they could fire me. I'm one of the best employees they ever had. How could they do this to me? I never got fired like this before I got sober. I mean, I try. I work the program. I never say no to AA requests, and they fired me. How can they do this to me? What's going to happen? I mean, I've been abandoned, and it goes on and on and on. And about 10 years later, you hear the same guy, and he's speaking at a meeting, and he says, and 10 years ago, I made a career change, and today I own my own company. And it just doesn't sound the same, you know, when you're telling it. And I try and remember that. When I started law school, it was really, it was a very scary experience for me. I was sure that, that God had made a mistake, and that this was, a way that I was going to finally be humiliated, you know, because I knew that there, when I was going to school, there weren't any other, like, dirty little Venice broads there, you know. I mean, I looked around. I know them. They weren't there. And being in law school is where I had to really work on being a snob. And you may think that's kind of strange for me to say, coming from where I come from, but it's been an interesting lesson that I've had to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard this guy, and he was talking about being an egomaniac. And he says, you know, an egomaniac is not someone who thinks well of themselves. It's not necessarily someone who even thinks often of themselves. It's someone who thinks only of themselves. And I was an egomaniac of the worst variety. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous as one of the worst snobs that I've known since I've been here. Because I didn't like anyone that hadn't come from exactly where I came from. If you hadn't come from the streets, if you didn't have the kind of mother, alcoholic mother that I had, if you had a father, which I never had, I didn't like you. If you had a car, which we never had, I didn't like you. If your parents were married, I didn't like you, because my mom was never married, you know. If you had nice clothes, I didn't like you. If you had more than one pair of shoes, I didn't like you. And I had all these different rules and thoughts, you know, and it went in Alcoholics Anonymous and out. And I'd see somebody, you know, some of those speakers, and they'd walk up to the podium, and they'd be dressed nice, and I'd think, oh, come on, man. They don't know what it's about out there. They haven't really hit the bottom like I hit the bottom. They never felt pain like I hit pain. Because I was, just as it talks about in the big book, I was selfish and self-centered, and I was sure no one else had ever hurt the way that I had hurt. And there were only a very few people like Paul, people that I could open up to a little bit, because I thought, yeah, maybe he's suffered a little, you know, like I have. And when I'd been sober for a very short period of time, I ended up getting a woman for a sponsor, something that is one of the miracles in my life. Talks about in the book that we are people who normally would not mix, and they meant my sponsor Gail and I directly when they wrote that. When I got sober and I was going to these 21 meetings a week, it seemed like a woman named Gail Wilson spoke at about 18 of them every week. I thought to myself, you know, maybe if I ask this woman to be my sponsor, I can find out ahead of time where she's speaking, and then I won't have to go hear her. And that's how I got a woman for a sponsor. I'd go to the Brentwood meeting, I'd see Gail, and she'd see me, and I'd go over and check in with her, and she'd say, June, don't sit next to me at the meeting. I said, I can't take the cigar smoke. See, that's, and she'd say, and I'd turn to walk away, and she'd say, and not only that, please don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor. And that was okay with me, you know, because I didn't want anybody to know I was hanging out with someone like Gail. I mean, Gail had actually, like, she'd been seen wearing pink in public. She not only didn't use the kind of language that I used, she didn't know what some of the words I was using meant. You know, it was, so we'd meet secretly after meetings and talk about AA. And when Gail had been sober for a while, about 5 years, Gail called me up and she said, you know this new baby of mine, Linda? And I said, yeah, I know her. So I want you to be friends with Linda. I thought, oh, come on. All right, well, let me tell you about Linda a little bit, all right? Now, some of the people here, I met a guy today, I think it was Steve, that used to live in Santa Barbara, and he definitely knows Linda, so he can vouch for my opinion anyway of Linda. Linda is and was one of the most strikingly physically beautiful women I have ever known. Beautiful blonde hair, gorgeous. I mean, she knows exactly how to put clothes together. She never has a chipped nail, you know what I mean? Her makeup is perfect. She's just incredible. She came from a wonderful family in Santa Barbara, quite a bit of money. Her mother and her father loved her. She's been all over the world. She's a stewardess. She's had all kinds of cars. She's had all kinds of wonderful jewelry. I mean, you know, and I say to my sponsor, what does she need a friend for? You know, I mean, I want to go into meetings with someone like this. You know, I'm barely wearing shoes, right? I mean, I don't want to be her friend. We don't have anything to talk about. And she's like, she's not from where I come from. I don't want to be her friend. And my sponsor got mad at me. Wasn't one of the only times, I'll let you know. And she said, you know, June, she said, has it ever occurred to you that when someone tries to kill themselves, it really doesn't matter whether they're laying in an alley in Venice or in a hotel room in Paris, that the feelings when you're ready to die and you want to kill yourself because you hate yourself so much are exactly the same? I thought, no, it never occurred to me. And I started to realize from that was true. And Linda became one of my closest friends and is one of my very dearest friends today. And she's, again, one of the people in the big book where it talks about, you know, we normally could not have mixed, because I never would have let someone like that in my life. And she's a very, very special, wonderful, wonderful friend. And I would have missed it had it not been for Alcoholics Anonymous and for my sponsor, Gail. And when I went to law school, I was still, you know, dealing with some of those issues, and I looked around, and here are these people, you know, and they had mothers and fathers, I mean, you know, that were still married. It wasn't their fault, you know, exactly, but, and I started, though, to see them as God's kids, and I started to realize that I was God's kids, and I started to really believe it and accept it, and it's been a feeling that I have with me almost all the time now. I don't really feel any better than or any less than anyone else. I know I'm just one of God's kids, you know, and some of us dress a little different and some of us come from a little bit of different place, but we all have the same feelings. And that isn't really just people in Alcoholics Anonymous necessarily either. I met a lot of people outside. And I started to learn when I was in law school that I'd been given a very special gift in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been given a sense of humor. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have a sense of humor. I didn't think anything was funny. Anything about my life, there wasn't anything funny that had ever happened. It was all crying time as far as I was concerned. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned to laugh. And I learned in law school that everyone doesn't necessarily have the same sense of humor that I have. You know, I was talking to this one guy, and he was very square. He was from behind the orange curtain down in Orange County. And we were talking about this movie called The Rose. And this movie was a story about Janis Joplin. And I didn't even think this guy knew who Janis Joplin was, you know. And he says, yeah, he says, you know, I always idolized Janis Joplin. And I said, really? I was just so surprised. And he says, oh, yeah. He says, but, you know, there's this one thing about this movie that really bothered me. I said, well, what was that? He said, well, there's this part in this movie where Janis is about to have an affair with this man. And she turns to this man and she says, I have a confession to make. She says, when I was in high school, I slept with the entire high school football team. And this guy at law school, he says to me, he says, you know, if that was true about Janis, he says, I just don't think I could ever respect her again. And I looked him right in the eye and I said, you mean you'd hold one football team against a girl? And he didn't talk to me for the next couple of years, you know. I never even went to high school, you know. What do I know about the high school football team? I'm going to talk about a couple more areas. When I got sober, I was single. I suppose when you're 13, that's a good idea. But I didn't think so. because I knew that people who were married lived happily ever after. See, and they never had any problems. I always knew that if my mom had only been married, you know, my life really would have been perfect. Of course, if you hang around Alcoholics Anonymous for a while, you begin to wonder sometimes whether you can either get married or live happily ever after. But started wondering, you know. Anyway, I found out, and some of you may be learning this, I know Ken mentioned it this morning, that if you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you're single, I have what's been some very bad news for me. You're probably going to have to learn to date. Now, I hate dating. I've always hated dating. I mean, it's just awful. I'd much rather fall in love. And usually have. You know, I'm the kind of person, on the way to the coffee pot, I fall in love. And then the next night, if he comes to the meeting with someone else, I think he's being unfaithful, you know. And if you're sober and you're single and you have to learn to date, then, well, in L.A., we have AA dates. I don't know if you guys have them here in Florida, but an AA date in L.A., a guy asks you out and then he takes you to a meeting. I mean, where else would you go? You know. And then after the meeting, he takes you to coffee and you talk about the meeting. And by the time he takes you home, you don't know whether to kiss him goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. I guess you have those here too. Well, I was on one of those dates one time. I was at the coffee stage of my date. And this guy said, you know, I really like you. And I said, well, thank you. You know, I like you too. And he said, no, I really like you a lot. And I said, thank you very much. He said, but I like your girlfriend at the next table better. Do you mind if I go sit with her? And I said, no, not at all. You know, I'm a tough broad from Venice. Who cares, right? So he did, and I went home, and I thought things through. Sort of like Ken said, my sponsors have been able to convince me that I've never yet had a problem that's been as bad as my solution for it. But I thought things through, and I came up with the only logical answer in that circumstance. I got up the next morning, and I went down and tried to join the United States Air Force. I figured, screw it, you know. And the Air Force wouldn't take me. So then I called my sponsor. You know, and that's what I recommend. If the Air Force won't take you, then you might want to try calling your sponsor, you know. When during the early years of my sobriety, I got emotionally involved. And, you know, I really, you know, I was doing the same thing a lot of people are when they get sober as far as trying to figure out this higher power thing, you know. But when I got a boyfriend, then I kind of thought you should either have a higher power or a boyfriend. I didn't think it was really fair to have both. And I had a boyfriend, and it was a lot easier to have him because he answered back. And so I didn't really work on this higher power thing, and I kind of knew that this was wonderful and perfect and everything, and then we broke up. And I felt feelings at that time that I had never felt in my entire life. Because I never got anywhere near pain or emotional. You know, I didn't get emotionally involved with anyone. I never let my feelings show with anyone. And I started to feel that pain of rejection that I had always drank and taken something before when it was three blocks away and I thought it might even be coming. And I sat there and I didn't know how to deal with that, you know, and I thought this AA thing is not going to work because I can't stay sober with pain like this. I've always had to drink when I feel this much pain. And I was, as I said, I was thinking, you know, and right then there was a knock at my door. And I went to the door and there was this guy named Bob from AA. I said, well, how you doing, Bob? And he says, how you doing? And I said, well, you know, okay. And he said, well, you know, are you ready? And I said, am I ready for what? And he said, well, remember I told you a couple weeks ago that Central Office had asked me to get some people together to go over to this high school and you said that you'd go. And I said, Bob, let me tell you something. I said, experience, strength, and hope I really don't have right now, okay? I was just going to go in the bathroom. I was thinking about killing myself, you know? I really don't have anything to share. And he says, well, have you had dinner? And I said, no. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, let's go get something to eat. We'll go by the school. He said, you don't have to say anything. I'll just talk for a little while. And then I'll bring you home and you can kill yourself. And I said, okay. So we went ahead and we went. Now, I wouldn't talk to Bob and I wouldn't let him play the radio, see, because, you know, if you talk to somebody, you could start to feel better. So I didn't want to do that. I was deep in thought. And when you're in that kind of pain, unless you really concentrate and you shut everyone out, you're really going to miss some of the pain, see? So I was deep in pain, and I was feeling the pain not only of, you know, losing this guy and knowing that, you know, that this wasn't going to work out, but you, in order to feel the maximum amount of pain, you have to think about the fact that not only did this relationship not work, but you have to feel the pain of knowing there will never be anyone else again. And, you know, if you have a radio going or you're talking to somebody, you could miss some of that. So I was deep, deep in thought. And we pulled up at this school, and we were walking, you know, I was just kind of blindly following Bob into this meeting, and this woman I'd never seen before walked up to me and she said, "Excuse me, do you know where room 235 is?" And I said, "No." She said, "Well, would you help me find it?" I thought, all right. I mean, Jesus. You know, can you believe what they ask of you when you're in this much pain? So, I mean, this absolute stranger, you know, she has to ask me when I'm dying like this. So I walk around the school and I get her lost. And as we're walking, she starts to talk and she says, "What kind of class are you taking?" She wants to chat, you know. I want to chat. So I'm not taking a class. She said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I came with some people. You know, we're going to talk a little bit about alcoholism." She said, "Really, for it or against it?" I said, "Well, I guess you'd say against it. I haven't really heard of very many talks for alcoholism, you know." And she said, "Really?" She said, "I'm on the wagon." And I said, "Well, that's terrific." I said, "I've known a lot of people on the wagon. They usually fall off." I said, "But that's great if it's working for you." And she said, "Well, why would you be giving that kind of a talk?" And I says, "Because I'm an alcoholic, and I stay sober one day at a time through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go to a meeting sometime?" And she said, "Yes," and we traded phone numbers. Obviously, I couldn't go home and kill myself. She'd think AA didn't work. So the next day, I took Kay to a meeting, and I took Kay to lots and lots of meetings. And Kay didn't stay sober at that time, but I did. And I learned what it said in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous when it says that when all else fails, try working with another alcoholic. I didn't even know at that point that in my mind all that was going on was it's all failing, you know. Today, though, Kay is sober. On August 3rd, I believe she's going to celebrate, I think it's 14 continuous years of sobriety. And she has every bit as much to do with my being in Alcoholics Anonymous today as I had to do with her being here. I went on and I had some other, you know, dating kind of experiences. I found, though, you know, as I look back on my life, I started to realize that I was having a little problem with having a relationship, and a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous kind of explained part of the problem. You see, I was the kind of person that I really wanted to have a relationship. But this is kind of the way I would relate to a guy. I meet a guy, and this is how what I do. I think, "I don't need you. I don't care whether you live or die. It makes no difference to me whether you stick around or not, okay?" All right. Now, what I was really thinking was, you know, as soon as he says, "I love you and I can't live without you," then I'm going to say, "Me too." See? And then we'll be happy. The funny thing is, is the one you kind of meet and go out with people and you tell them, "I don't need you. I could care less if you live or die. And it makes no difference to me whether you're around or not." They hardly ever say, "I love you and I can't live without you." It's really bizarre how that hardly ever happens, you know. Anyway, I went to law school after I'd been there a little while. I got asked out by this guy. And you know, I mean, it was just silly. He was a nice Jewish boy from Chicago. He had no tattoos. He'd never even been to jail, let alone prison. You know, why would I go out with him? And we've been going out one day at a time for the last 8 years. After we started, we've been dating for, just a couple of months, and he came home with two tickets to Chicago. He's from a very large family. And he wanted to take me home because he wanted to introduce me to the people that mattered the most in his life, because he was so proud of me. So proud of what Alcoholics Anonymous had made me. And I couldn't help but think at that time, and when I went back to meet his family, how when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, my own family wouldn't even let me in their doors, not for a long, long time. I was well over 5 years sober before I was ever allowed in their home. I think I was closer to 10 years sober before I was allowed to have any kind of keys. Our life is not perfect as we've gone out, but it's been the best relationship that I've ever had. It's kind of funny. We were scheduled to get married last November, and right around October, this woman called me up, and I think she was from back in New York. I've never met her. And she called me up because she was in this relationship. Well, she'd been in this relationship and it had just ended. And she was in a lot of pain, and she knew, of course, the reason she was in so much pain was because she knew that this relationship wasn't supposed to end, because this was the right one. You know, this was the only one, and this was the right one. And we talked, and I shared with her the fact that at that time, when I was walking around that schoolyard and I was thinking about killing myself, that this guy that I went out with, I'd been going out with him for about 2 years, and in 2 years he'd never even bought me dinner. Well, once I think he bought me a taco at Taco Bell. But in 2 years he never even took me out to dinner, and that was the kind of guy that I knew was right for me, you know, and I was going to kill myself because God took him away. You know, and today I am married to a man who has taken me to several different countries to visit, and he takes me out to dinner on a regular basis, and sometimes I take him out to dinner. We have a relationship that he knows that I care about him, and he knows that I love him, and he knows that he matters a lot, and I know the same. And it doesn't mean that that I'm weak. And it's been such an interesting thing. You know, my sponsor Gail used to try and explain to me over and over and over. She said, "June, when are you going to learn that there's a difference between being strong and being tough? You know, that it has nothing to do with the things that you think it does, that your old ideas are all screwed up." And it's taken me many, many years. I'm not sure exactly how long, but it took a lot of years before I really started to see the difference. And today I'm stronger than I have ever been. And the interesting thing about that is that there are more people in the world, in this room, and in a whole lot of others that know that they could hurt my feelings and that they matter in my life. It's a complete paradox to what I thought. I don't want to be tough anymore. And there aren't any tough people in my life. You know, it's not the way that I want to surround my life anymore. I want to tell a couple of other little stories. You know, it's funny, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, the way that I did, and having a couple people tell me that, you know, maybe I didn't really belong and I was too young and things like that, you'd think that I'd be like ultra sensitive and I would never even, it would never even occur to me in my wildest dreams to consider that someone did not belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, that's what it seems like it should be to me. And yet that's not the case. I was at the Monday Night Venice group, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago now, something like that. And we had this guy that was, they were bringing to meetings. His name was Catfish. I mean, that wasn't really his name, but that's what everybody called him. And Catfish was crazy. He was crazy. He'd sit in the front row of the meeting, he'd stick straws up his nose, and he'd grab flies, imaginary flies, and he'd eat them during the meeting. And he was very distracting, because I always sit in the front row, so it particularly bothered me. And I knew, I mean, this guy, if anybody ever had a wet brain, I mean, this guy was beyond help. And it really irritated me, you know, that he was sitting in the meeting distracting me and the newcomers, you know, with this. And I really didn't think he should be allowed to come to meetings. But I didn't say anything, you know. But I really, that's what I thought. And I just kept going to these meetings, and I'd see him. And, you know, and sometimes, like, he'd ask, you know, people for rides home, and he was just downright scary. You know, I mean, he really was. He was just out of it. And this was a couple years later. I was driving down the street, and I pulled up at a red light, and I looked over at the bus bench, and there was Catfish. And he looked right at me. He saw me. I mean, you know, I had to offer him a ride. He didn't have any straws in his nose or anything. So he gets in my car, and we kind of, you know, we kind of talked a little bit, and it was kind of weird, you know. Turns out Catfish had a daughter. I mean, can you imagine? I just couldn't believe it, you know. And he wasn't really able to make sentences, you know, but he just said a couple different words and stuff, and I just kind of looked at him kind of, it was just kind of strange. And I guess it's been maybe, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. Let's see, that was 10 years ago, so maybe about 7 years ago now. I was sitting in that Westwood meeting, and I was just sitting there. It was the end of the meeting, and they do the birthday cakes out in California at the end. And all of a sudden they said, "And tonight we have a cake for 7 years for Walter." And Catfish got up. And Catfish was wearing a navy blue suit and a little yellow tie. He looked kind of like Shipwreck in his conservative days. And he walked up there and he sounded just like one of my school professors. And I would have kept him out of AA. You know, I wouldn't have thought that he could make it here. I didn't think that that we had anything left to offer him. And so I try and remember that sometimes when I see someone sitting there that I think's gone too far, or hadn't gone far enough, or isn't the right, you know, quality for our group, something like that. I, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, I was walking down the street in Culver City, and saw this little old drunk come walking down the street, and we kind of looked each other in the eyes. And we recognized each other, and it was Paul. And Paul and I started talking a little bit, and he was on his way to this pet store with his little bird, Petey. And Petey was the only friend that Paul had. Paul's family wouldn't talk to him anymore, and he lived in this little old drunk hotel. And Paul was telling me that the night before, Petey had been able to almost fly away. And Paul thought he was just going to die if he lost Petey, because that was the only person he had, only thing he had left to talk to. And Paul and I, we stood there and we talked, and I said, you know, let's go get some coffee. There's this little coffee shop across the street, and we went in and we sat in there. And I ordered coffee and Paul ordered a beer. Probably the only person I could think of that I've known since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous that I thought was an alcoholic that I bought a drink for. And we sat there and we talked. And he asked me what was going on, and I told him that, you know, I was living nearby, and I'd finished school, and I was a lawyer, and he asked if he could see one of my business cards, and I showed him one, and he started crying. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I must have taught you really well. And I told him that he had. And isn't it amazing sometimes that the people that teach us the best don't even get the message themselves? I don't know when, you know, whether he'll come in here someday. I hope so. I don't know how some of us get the gift and some of us miss it. I'm not quite sure how that works out. I'm going to tell just one other area of my life a little bit. When I got sober, one of the speakers that talked an awful lot in my area and that I know many of you've heard was Chuck Chamberlain. A lot of what Chuck used to talk about really didn't make a whole lot of sense to me until I was sober quite a while. One of the things I remember him talking about from the very beginning is he would stand up, especially at the Monday Night Venice group, I remember, and he would say that he got out there and he tried to be of service. He'd get up in the morning, he'd try and get out there and he'd help God's kids do what they need to have done because he wanted to. And that was kind of what it was all about. That was what his whole 11th step was all about. And then he'd stand up there and he'd say, and if any of you are sitting out there tonight and you go to work Monday through Friday just to get a paycheck and to have the weekend off, you're cheating yourself and everyone that you come in contact with. And I thought about what he said and it just made absolutely no sense. And he'd say it again. If there's anybody out there and they go to work Monday through Friday just to get a paycheck and to have the weekends off, they're cheating themselves and everyone that they come in contact with. And I thought, he's got to be crazy. I mean, first of all, he's got to be rich, too, to say something stupid like that, you know? Because it's all about your paycheck and having the weekend off. I mean, everybody knows that. You drag into work on Monday, it kind of ruins your life for 5 days, and then Saturday you have a fairly good day, Sunday's kind of wrecked because you know you have to go back the next day, and then you sort of, you know, slop through the whole week miserable waiting for Saturday or Friday night again, you know, and getting the paycheck and counting it up and knowing it's never enough because they don't pay you right, you know, as much as you work, and, you know, they've undervalued you. And I just couldn't figure out what he was saying, and I was sober about maybe 8 or 9 years. And I was at the, I was waitressing. And I'd go to work and, I'd serve the tables and I'd run in the kitchen and then I'd count up my tips, you know, cause you make most of your money on tips, and I count up my tips and I think, Jesus Christ. I mean, $5.75. I've been here for 2 hours. How am I gonna support myself on this? This is absolutely ridiculous, you know, and then they're like, Matt, can I have some mustard, horseradish, some sweet and low and more coffee, you know, and I think, geez. You know, they're going to leave me 50 cents. I can buy a magazine, you know? Anyway, and I'd run back out there, and then I'd work for another hour, and then I'd go back, and I'd count my tips, and I'd know I was never going to make it, and it would just drive me crazy. And all of a sudden, one night, I was back there, and I was counting my tips, and somehow I thought of Chuck, and I thought about what he said, and I thought about the fact that, you know, my whole life was just ruined. It was ruined when I was at work. It was ruined when I wasn't at work, when I was afraid that I had to go back to work. It was ruined on my days off, thinking about going back, you know, and I hardly ever enjoyed my days off, and that whole thing. And I thought about what he said, you know, if you go to work Monday through Friday just to have the time off and your paycheck, you're cheating yourself and everyone that you come in contact with. And then he talked about how he'd get up and he'd just try and get out there and be of service. He'd help God's kids do what they needed to have done because he wanted to. And I thought about that, and I started to go out there, and I started to give those people their food because they needed it. Because they had to have their food so that they could go on and they could get out there and be of service to God's kids the way that they needed to. And if they needed a little bit of mustard to help them to go out there and be of better service, that was my job. And I was able to get out there and to start to do it. And I'd love to stand up here and say, you know, from then on I made $500 a night instead of $550. That's not true. It does seem like I made maybe a little bit more money, but that isn't really the point. The point was the way that I felt. My time just kind of sailed by. I'd be looking, and everybody else, you know, was looking at their watch about 27 times a night. I'd look at mine, and it was 10 minutes past when I was already supposed to get off, and I absolutely couldn't believe it. And I started to learn what a wonderful, wonderful lesson it was. And today in the job that I have, I'm able to be of service. You know, I work in criminal defense, and I meet a lot of future members of Alcoholics Anonymous while I'm out there. And I meet some that used to be members that aren't right now, and I see where this disease takes them, and I see the progression. And I'm able to be out there and to be of service. And most of the time I go to work Monday through Friday, not just to get my paycheck and to have the weekend off, but to try and be of service. And those are the days that just kind of sail by, and the weeks sort of sail by. And I highly recommend it. Those of you who are working, I don't care where you're working, you take a look around, and I guarantee you that you'll be able to tell just by the looks on the people's faces, the people who are there just to get their paycheck and to have the weekend off, and the people who are there to be of service and because they want to put something into that place that they're working. And I guarantee you which people are having the most fun. It's just as simple as night and day, and I couldn't see it for a long, long time. Kind of like, you know, Ken was sharing and Chuck used to always say, you can't see it until you can see, and you can't hear until you can hear. I was at work, and I'd been there for quite a while and a couple of years, and I wasn't worried about getting promoted, and I wasn't worried about, you know, rising up and going to the top, because that doesn't work for me. When I get into thinking about competition and what's mine and what I and what I need and how come they're not recognizing me and things like that, it just makes me miserable and crazy. And so what I do is I just leave that all up to God, and I just show up and try and be of service. And I'd been at work for a couple years, and this boss of mine called me in, and there's about 500 lawyers in the office that I work in, and he called me in and said, you know, June, we got 37 branches that we have out in Los Angeles, and we're going to have to transfer you from the downtown main branch, but I'd like to know which of those places would be the ones that would be the best for you. And if there's any way we can do it, we'd like to try and give you one of those assignments because we're really very happy with you. And I was really touched, you know. I mean, I was really flattered that this guy even, you know, recognized who the hell I was out of all these lawyers. And I told him the two assignments, you know, that would be the best. And one was Inglewood and one was Santa Monica. And Santa Monica would be by far the best because it's the closest to my house, you know. But either one would have been great. And about a week later, I found out that I got Inglewood. And I was very grateful. I was very touched that this man had taken the time to think about where I'd like to go and then had made some arrangements to help me get that assignment out of all the many that I could have gotten. It was just great. Until about 10 minutes later, when I found out about this woman who'd been in the office less time than I had, and she got Santa Monica on the same day. Of course, she just happens to be very close friends with the number two man in our office, you know. And I was really pissed. And I talked to God, and I said, this is not spiritual. You know, I mean, how am I supposed to believe that you're going to take care of everything if it's this who you know, and how you get where you're supposed to get, you know, because of your parents were best friends with so-and-so. And I thought, you know, I mean, I just can't believe this. I was very disillusioned. And they sent me out to Inglewood, and I was just plain mad, you know, and I had a bad attitude. And I started working out there, and all I could think of was, she's in Santa Monica. That's where the beach is. It's close to my house. It's where I'm supposed to be. And I rah, rah, rah. And then, of course, you know, I started thinking. I thought about the Serenity Prayer, and I thought about the things I've been taught here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, you know, I got a couple choices here. I can leave, and I can go get another job. I have the courage to change that if that's what I want to do. Or I can accept the fact that I'm in Inglewood, and I can be the best attorney that I can be while I'm here and try and be of service. And I decided to go ahead and try and do that. And I went ahead, and I tried to get out there, and I tried to be of service, and I had a wonderful time in Inglewood. I got transferred a few months later back to the downtown office. In the meantime, this woman out in Santa Monica that had my job had a nervous breakdown because the stress was so bad. I got downtown, and they put me in charge of a training program with the new lawyers that were coming into the office. And my boss called me in. This was a different boss, and he called me in, and he said, June, I wanted to let you know, he said, that we brought you back down here because we want you to work with the new lawyers because we love your attitude about work and about, you know, your job. And I thought, oh my God, let me tell you that there isn't anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1972 who ever thought I'd get a job for my attitude, you know. I want to tell you that I believe that all of the answers that I have needed have come from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that, and this is all my opinion, as I said in the very beginning, I got a lot of people out in my area that seem to get a few years sober, and it seems to me like instead of working the steps and instead of working the program, they start going to some other different programs and they get a therapist and they get a counselor and they start running around. And, you know, I'm sure every one of us has thought when we hear that line in the book about having grave emotional and mental disorders that we're the one that they meant. I happen to believe that that there are very few that they were directing that statement at, and that all of the answers are within the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have found that all of the promises of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous have come true for me. I want to read them to you, and I want to see if I can point out something when I'm done that I never noticed until just about a year or so ago. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. I realized about a year ago when I was reading over those promises that many of them have to do with the fact, not me becoming anything great, not me becoming a better person or liking myself better or things like that really, but me being able to turn my eyes away from myself and get out and be of service and look around and see where I can add something to life. Instead of just calling up my sponsor and seeing what they can give me and how they can make me better, I started to be able to call and just see if maybe I could brighten up their day. You know, maybe I could just add a little bit to their life. And that's what I've been able to try and do. I can't believe it. I came into this program as much a taker as anybody that I've ever seen. And in the years that I have been here, I have learned that I don't know whether I should say the answer, but that the way of life that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer has taught me to be able to give. And then on the days that I'm able to do that and to turn my eyes away from me, those are the happiest days that I've ever had. I told you about how I hated myself and how I didn't like myself and how I couldn't look in a mirror. And I'm going to share one or two other stories with you about that, and then I'm sitting down. I went to a convention when I was about 5 years sober in Palm Springs, and I was looking around the room comparing myself to everybody else in the room, as I always had done and still very often do. And as I looked around the room, you know, I was wearing this long brown dress. I looked around the room and I saw this beautiful, I think it was a black dress, and I thought, wow. I mean, don't you wish you were wearing that gorgeous black dress? And I said, no. I thought, what do you mean, no? I talked to myself. What do you mean, no? No, I'm really glad I'm wearing this brown dress. And I looked around, and I think I saw a green dress, and green's my favorite color. And I said, don't you wish you were wearing that green dress? And I thought, nope, I'm really glad I'm wearing this brown dress. And I absolutely could not believe it. And then I started asking myself other questions. And I realized for the first time in my life, right then, right there, I wanted to have red curly hair. I wanted to be tall and skinny. I wanted to be wearing my dress. I wanted to be sitting at the table that I was sitting at. I absolutely couldn't believe it. And more important than all of that, and that's very important for someone who came from where I came from, I didn't want to feel like anybody else. I didn't want to be living anyone else's life. And I'd love to be able to tell you that since that day, from the time I was about 5 years sober till then, I've never wanted to do or be anything else but me. That's not true. There's a lot of days I'd rather be blonde or stacked, you know? But most of the time, I like who I am and what Alcoholics Anonymous has made me. And when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1972, there wasn't anyone here that could have told me that someday I wouldn't want to trade places with anyone else in the whole world. And in November of last year, I got married. And I had a wedding that is the best wedding that I've ever been to. And I had a dress that was the most beautiful dress that I've ever seen in my life. And I was the most beautiful woman that I've ever known at that particular moment. And it took me days to find the right kind of shoes. You know, I mean, I didn't even wear shoes when I got here. And what was the most special probably about that is that every member of my family came from many different states to be there. And two of my grandparents are both dead, but a brother from each of their families came from Canada. They'd never been to the United States, but they came to represent that part of my family and to be with me on that day. And there wasn't anyone in my family that would have driven the 5 miles from Culver City to Venice when I got sober in 1972. I don't know how these things happen. You know, I got to tell you, I mean, there's no way I would have planned these things. You know, Ken was talking about the reality surpassing his wildest dreams. I'm going to let you know that when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any dreams. I didn't want to be anything. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to grow up and be something. I just wanted to die, and I couldn't do it. And I stuck around here. And after I'd been sober for a while, they gave me some dreams. And then some of the people that came before and some of the people that have come after me, they've stood around me and in front and behind and on my sides, and they've helped some of those dreams come true. And what I want to let you know is if you're sitting there and you're new and you don't have any dreams, stick around and we'll find you some. And if you've been around for a while and you're sitting there and you're sure that your dreams are never going to come true, maybe they're not. Maybe we're going to find you some different ones, but please don't give up before the miracle happens in your life. Thanks again for letting me be part of it.